Hi, folks. This is Pastor Warren, and today I'm going to continue with Dr. Jay Richards' book, Money, Greed, and God, which is a really terrific book about things having to do with the economy. I want to look at chapter 3 today and just kind of share with you some of the things from the chapter. Best thing, of course, would be for you just to read it yourself because it's a terrific read. But I want to spread out this message as far as I can because I just think it's very appropriate and very needed in our day. This chapter 3 is titled, Doesn't Capitalism Foster Unfair Competition? And so Dr. Richard starts the chapter off by talking about his own history and how he used to be worried about capitalism as a young man. And he has some quotes from some famous people like Jack London, a Yale social scientist, and even former presidential candidate Walter Mondale, people who all say that capitalism is like, you know, the law of the jungle. It's survival of the fittest. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and the devil take the hindmost. And so that was really disturbing to Richards as a young man, and he asked the question, isn't capitalism really just theft on a big scale? Isn't it a zero-sum game where if somebody wins, that means of necessity that somebody else has to lose? I imagine a lot of even Christians today think that way about capitalism. But to answer the question, Richards tells a really humorous story about a time when he was in sixth grade and it was so snowy outside that the teacher had them stay in at recess. And to keep them occupied, she had them play what she called the trading game. She had all these cheap little gifts, and she gave each kid one gift without consideration of who they were. So Richards got a pack of Barbie trading cards. Wow. And another kid got one of those paddleball things with the rubber ball, you know, and an elastic string. Another kid got a pack of double mint chewing gum, etc., etc. The teacher had each kid mark what his or her gift was worth to them on a scale from 1 to 10. And then they added up that total and she wrote it on the board. Then she allowed them all to trade with another kid at their same table of 5 and mark the gift they traded for as worth. So when they added those all up, the value of everything had gone up. Then she said that the kids could trade with anybody in the whole room and the value again went up. Yet the gifts, they hadn't changed. They were the same. They just changed hands. And the point is, Richard says, all I ever needed to know about economics, I learned in the sixth grade. And he proceeds to tell you 7 lessons that he learned. Number 1, trading freely can add value even though the traded items remain physically unchanged. Number 2, normally, when trading freely, the more trading partners there are, the better. Number 3, a free exchange is a win-win game. Number 4, the game is win-win because of the rules set up beforehand. In other words, it wasn't anarchy where the strong took from the weak and all like that. Number 5, scarcity is almost always real. The supply of toys wasn't limitless, but the kids still ended up happier when they traded. Number 6, opportunity costs. You could trade and get something better, but you couldn't have anything or everything. You had to decide what you were going to trade for, and that's all you could get. And number 7, economic value is in the eye of the beholder. The paddleball thing was really neat for Richards, but the Barbie trading cards, they were useless. So, neat little illustration, and what it shows is how economies work in a simplistic way. And then Richards talks about how even famous economists and people like Karl Marx haven't demonstrated over the years that they really understand some of these principles. They thought, Marx, for example, that you should be able to figure out the reasonable cost for things based on the labor that went into them and the cost of materials and so on. But Richard shows in this book how that's false. And he uses the example of construction, like for houses. And he says, just because a developer pays his workers a certain amount and uses a certain amount of materials, that doesn't determine the value of the houses he builds. What determines the value is the price that buyers are willing to pay. And that is just a truth of the market. That's why Marx was wrong, and even a lot of Christians are still wrong today. They get this wrong. Marx talked about, for example, a capitalist who starts a furniture company. And so he puts so much money into buying wood and so forth, and he has so much money in the labor to build chairs, and he pays these workers and so on. Then he sells the chairs for more than the amount that he paid for the materials and the work. So Marx said he was exploiting the workers. He was stealing from the people that he sold to. But of course, that's just really a lie. The workers got jobs out of the whole thing, and they were happy to get the salaries that they agreed to. And the factory owner, what he did is he used resources, and he got people to work for him and combined the resources and the labor and so on. And then he did marketing, and then he sold his chairs for more than they cost, but it was not more than others were willing to pay. So as a result, he was rewarded with profit for his entrepreneurial effort. So the thing is, there's no exploitation there, no injustice, no contradiction that'll inevitably lead to class warfare and revolution. Marx was dead wrong. But people today, even Christians, still think this way. There's a pretty prominent Christian, liberal Christian man named Jim Wallace. He said that it was a fraud because the CEO of a big company made $13.5 million, while some of his minimum wage laborers only made, you know, $10,700 a year. But Richard says, you know, a fraud, really? Unless those workers were lied to or forced to work, or the CEO lied about his record, there's no fraud. Everyone's chosen freely to work for their wages. Here's a quote. Economic value is not only in the eye of the beholder. The beholder's eye can see things differently in different circumstances. Richard says, I'll value the same glass of water much more if I'm hot and thirsty and miles from any other water than if I'm sitting in my air-conditioned kitchen where I can get a glass of ice water anytime I want. And I'll value the 10th refill of that glass less than the first, even though the same amount of labor was required to make each of the glasses available to me. So even though I need water to survive, I usually can get water whenever I want it, so it's practically free. In contrast, a painting by Van Gogh, which no one really needs, is still really expensive. Part of the reason is because the paintings are scarce. Unlike with water, you can't get a Van Gogh free from a Dutch impressionist dispenser in a department store. But that's not the whole story. Van Goghs aren't only scarce, they're desired. Lots of people will cough up serious dough to get one. And this affects the price for everyone. That's why, Richard says, I'd almost always prefer a Van Gogh to a glass of water. Only if I were dying of thirst would I prefer a glass of water to Starry Night, since in any other circumstances I could exchange the painting for millions of gallons of water anytime I wanted. So his point is that economic value has to do with how much people value goods and services in the marketplace, which is why Richards discusses the third myth. Remember, I told you he brings out the myths that people believe about capitalism in his book. And in this one, he brings out the third myth, which he calls the zero-sum game myth. This is the idea that trade requires a winner and a loser. Richard's point is that it's not win-lose at all. It's not zero-sum. He says this, free trade makes it possible for people to play win-win games of exchange. If we try to set up an economy based on the labor theory of value, which Marx talked about, then the government could build houses nobody really wanted and force people to pay what they'd invested in building them. That would lead to builders making poorly constructed houses because people would have to buy whatever they built, and the people wouldn't be happy with their homes. It wouldn't be a win-win, it'd be a lose-lose, and eventually the whole economy would fail, which is, by the way, exactly what happened to the Soviet Union and what continues to happen in every socialist economy. On the other hand, Richard says, if the developer can't make anybody buy his homes, well, then he's going to be more careful to build what people will freely buy. He'll look for ways to set up win-win situations for more people. He'll try to build for cheaper prices, make stuff more according to people's wishes, etc., etc. So even if he's a selfish man, he's going to be directed toward meeting the needs of others. If he does it well, guess what? People will be happy and he will get rich. It's a win-win situation. Likewise, workers are better off in this kind of a situation as well, in a free market situation, because they shouldn't be forced to work wherever or for whatever salary their government decides. If they can choose a job based on whether or not they think it's advantageous to them, they'll be happier and they'll do a better job. Now, sure, not everybody wins all the time. Sometimes there's losers, but guess what? It's still the best and the only good game in town, this capitalism system. Because even losers profit from the better and the cheaper goods and services that come about because of it. And even though they lost in some of the deals, they can get up and try again until they win too. So Richards then talks about how this works in real life. We don't trade toys, you know, but we trade our time, our skills, our knowledge, our training, our natural gifts, our good location, or whatever. And we all try to work it all out to our own advantage the best we can. And it has paid off in the most prosperous society in history. Of course, there's more to this than simple trade. You have to also have other things back of that that make it work, like the rule of law, the right to own property, etc. And so Richards has an interesting section on that and on property ownership. And there's been a lot of studies done that have shown that property ownership is really one of the keys to prosperity. His discussion, though, next of what he calls the mystery of the market is very interesting. I never had thought these things. That's why I recommend the book to you. It's amazing how the market works as billions and billions of people make decisions to buy, sell, invest, or whatever, and they're all trying to do the best they can for themselves. And this is what makes the market go up and down and it makes it balance out. If you tried to have central planning, which is the idea behind socialism, you just couldn't possibly do it. It's impossible because nobody can control all of this. And every time it's ever been tried, it causes starvation. Here's a quote. The price of a good or service in a free economy, then, is a little packet of information that tells us its economic value at that moment. It represents an underlying reality, not merely the random choice of a store clerk. So a market doesn't just distribute goods and services. It's a highly sensitive network for gathering and disseminating information that would otherwise elude us. And the thing is, in a free market, goods and services generally end up where they're most valued. Quote, in short, what emerges from a free market regulated by prices is not utopia, but it is an order more complex and efficient than any order that human planners have or even can devise, unquote. In the last section of this chapter, Richards has this fascinating story about iPencil and iPod. And it's really cute. And the iPencil story was written in the 50s. And so then Richards made an updated version, iPod. And in both of these stories, what they talk about is how many things there are that go into the creation and production of things, like, you know, a pencil or an iPod. And it's like I say, fascinating. But, you know, like even a pencil, it has cedar wood from one part of the world and graphite from another and copper to make brass from another. And it has the stuff that makes the eraser that comes from somewhere else. And you've got companies that are mining and producing and companies that are shipping and companies that are buying and selling and stores. And just so much goes into it. And of course, that's true of a pencil, and it's even more true of the iPod. I didn't even know. I thought iPod was just everything made by Apple, but it's not. It's made by Sony and all kinds of companies, and all kinds of materials go into making one. And so the point is that there's nobody in a central place who controls it all, but it just gets done, and it gets out there, and it gets bought, and people like them, and they're happy with them, and it's the mystery of the market. The market makes it all happen. Even socialist genius science fiction writer Isaac Asimov said that he couldn't understand how the market works and he didn't believe that anybody could. People talk about the market, how evil it is and how it's the law of the jungle and all that kind of stuff. But Richard's point is that really the market is rather almost miraculous when you consider all the free cooperation and the interdependence it requires and how, for the most part, the market works together for the good of most people. Again, there's more to it than just capitalism. There's a lot of stuff, rule of law and all that. And I've been reading some other books lately that tell about the history of some of the things that developed behind capitalism, made it possible. But the thing is, it's not an evil thing in and of itself. It's not based on slavery or coercion. And it's not the corrupt, unfair, or even criminal enterprise some people make it out to be. Some people, of course, still have a sneaking suspicion, though, that capitalism's linked to unfair competition, inequality, and poverty. A lot of people talk about that today. So chapter 4 is going to deal with that. And I hope you'll listen as I share what some of the insights from that chapter. Till next time, though, may the Lord bless you.